Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. We believe small actions can have great impact. Take a small action today. Speak to a financial broker about a Zurich pension.
You're welcome back to the programme. We were asking you at the top of the programme at 4:30 if you'd be in the queue for a vaccine if it were available here next week, as it may be in the north. The listener says, as soon as a vaccine is available, I'll be top of the queue. I haven't seen my only brother since March because he's immunocompromised, and my wife is a frontline A&E nurse, and I would love the freedom to give him a well-deserved bear hug and spend the evening talking nonsense over a few drinks, as one listener. But an opposing view from a listener says, no way would I take a dubious, fast-tracked vaccine for something that has a 99.8% recovery rate. Do not forget that these companies are exempt from liability madness. Well, for some more informed opinion, I am joined now by two people who are in the know because the UK's medicines regulator took many by surprise this morning by announcing the emergency authorisation of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine just 10 days after it began examining data from large-scale trials. Downing Street says it hopes to start the first vaccinations by early next week. Meanwhile, the European Medicines Agency says it will decide whether to provisionally authorise the vaccine by the 29th of December. In an unusually blunt statement, though, the agency said its longer approval procedure was more appropriate and required more checks than the UK approach. To discuss this, I'm joined by Professor Carina Butler, who's chair of Ireland's National Immunisation Advisory Committee, and from England by Professor Gabriel Scally, who's visiting professor of public health at the University of Bristol. You're both very welcome to the programme. And by God, have people been waiting in agony for all of this news for an awful lot of months now. But Carina, I'll come to you first, if you don't mind.
Okay.
From the European Union side, why is it taking longer than the UK approach to approve the vaccine?
First of all, both of these agencies have been looking at the data and going through it, not just in the last couple of weeks, but over the last number of months. There are probably slight differences in the processes between the two. In Europe, in the UK, obviously, you're just dealing with one country and one set of regulators dealing with it within the EU. You're accommodating and you have the scrutiny of all who are involved in it. There are also slight differences in the pathways that they're doing it as well. But, I mean, the thing is, this difference is actually very, very short. And it is, the good news is here we have not just one, but two, and not just two, but three regulatory agencies independently looking and scrutinising the data. And that's what we need, because that is what's going to give us the security and the confidence to know that if these vaccines, when they're passed for approval, that every precaution has been taken to make sure that they are safe to use.
Because that is key, isn't it, Professor Gabriel Scally, for a widespread uptake of the vaccine. People need to be reassured that this is safe and adequate safety measures have been taken in assuring that it is okay to take the vaccine. I mean, you heard the text I read from one dubious listener. Is it possible, I wonder at all, that the UK regulator came under intense political pressure to speed up the approval process?
I think all of us working in the field of dealing with COVID are under intense pressure from all sorts of sources. We want to do the best for our population. But these people who are involved in the regulatory process have been involved in this business for a very long time, have built up a huge amount of experience. And I personally would trust them that to do their job properly. I don't think they would be amenable to political process. And in the UK, it's actually been subject to two sets of review, both the MHRA, the Medicine and Healthcare Regulatory Agency, but also the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation, which has produced its guidance today, and they say they have reviewed all of the data and are very positive about what they've found. They say It looks very good indeed. And I think that is, you know, they say the vaccine appears to be safe and well tolerated and there were no clinically concerning safety observations.
Will you be,
well,
I don't know if this is
more expert than that.
I don't know if this is a fair question to answer, but would you be in the queue to get the vaccine now?
Oh, I would be head of the queue.
Top of the
queue.
Don't
you worry. I, as soon as my age group comes up, I will be there.
Well, that brings me to the next question, Gabriel Scally, because we're told by the Health Minister, Robin Swan, in the North that it could be as early as next week in the North, available there. Have they defined in the UK who will get it first? And could that inform our approach here?
They have, but I think there's room for debate over that. Now, the UK has gone for a very age-based approach, looking both at people, particularly those vulnerable in care homes, and also health and social care workers. But apart from that, people with underlying conditions, they haven't considered occupation really apart from those health and social care workers. If you look elsewhere in the world, New York State, for example, have given quite a high priority to other people, to first responders, to teachers, to transit employees, i.e. those working in transport in roles where we know from the UK data there's been quite an occupational mortality. So I think there is room for discussion. And I personally also think we should be deploying the vaccine in the places where the incidence, if we've got limited supplies, we should be deploying it in the places where the incidence of the virus is highest.
Well, can
I think that's the logical way forward.
Okay, can I ask you for your thoughts on that, Professor Karina Butler? Because if it's up for discussion, that is the discussion we'll be having now in the next week or so. Who should be prioritised?
Well, I think our principles would echo very much the thoughts that you're hearing there. The first thing is that we want to protect those who are at the greatest risk of disease, and we want to protect those who are at the greatest risk of acquiring infection and of transmitting infection. And so those are the overriding priorities that will inform the prioritization list. I think whatever list people come out with, there will always be slight variations or changes that you could argue for or against, but we all have the same goal, which is ultimately to protect those who are most likely to have a severe outcome and to stop, to break this virus circulating in our communities.
But the problem with what you outlined there is if you go out to protect the most vulnerable and also go out to protect the most likely to acquire the disease and to transmit it, what you're saying there is possibly the older group of the population and those with underlying illnesses, and those most likely to acquire it are people in the younger bracket going about their business in day-to-day activity. That's everybody.
Well, ideally we want to actually to vaccinate everybody at the end of the day, but obviously there has to be a prioritization because we won't have enough vaccine in the beginning. But I'm saying that those are the principles, and then you use that coupled with what you can actually do. And underlying that, obviously, is the ethical framework where you want to make sure that there is fairness and justice for all. Mm. And so at times, it can be a marrying of those two features because you may have that transmission is high in an area where there are vulnerable people. So that might be an area that will be targeted. So those are the factors that have gone into the discussions to inform what will be our prioritisation.
Dr. Scally?
It's a very good question. One of the things we don't know about the effect of the vaccine is whether it has some sort of, whether it's a sterilizing immunization. Now, that means that you stop the person actually developing COVID-19 infection and potentially being transmissible. What we know, we don't know about that. What we do know is that it protects people from the serious effects of getting the disease, but we don't know that it stops them being able to transmit. So, but we don't know that yet. We will find out in due course. But at the moment, we know it stops the disease. So therefore, the priority has to be those people who are most at risk, whether they be on grounds of age or occupation or underlying conditions.
But the difficulty, Dr. Scally,
that's what we have to do.
Can I put this to you, and maybe it's an unanswerable question, but if you have enough vaccines in the first batch that's to be rolled out to cover 70% of healthcare workers, for example, How do you decide then which 70% of people gets it?
Oh, it would. I think it would have to be. You would produce a prioritisation again, and you would give it to those people who would be most in contact with those the patients at most risk. So it would be those working with older people, people in with compromised immune systems. I mean, you'll have heard of there were terrible outbreaks in hospitals. One of them in Craigavon, actually, of people who were receiving treatment for their blood disorders. It compromised their immune system, and there was an outbreak of the virus in the hospital that caused their deaths, mm-hmm. and that was terrible. So healthcare workers working with those vulnerable people, working with really elderly people, and people in really frontline roles where they might be in contact with the virus from active cases coming into the hospital.
The difficulty,
that's all doable.
The difficulty, Karina, arises when you have, as I say, in the initial early January, the initial batch, you may only have enough vaccines to inoculate the older groups, or maybe residents of nursing homes, or certain categories of healthcare workers.
Yeah.
Who decides then?
Well, exactly, and that's what's gone into coming up with a prioritisation list, so we know if we're restricted what levels we go through. And I want to pick up on something Dr. Scally said, because it is important. He's absolutely right. We don't know whether this will break transmission, in the sense we don't know if it stops the virus replicating. We know it stops disease. So depending on what vaccines are available and depending on what we know about that, that could alter your prioritization list. So you may find in the beginning that the young healthy are rather low down the prioritization list, whereas if we found that that was where it's predominantly being transmitted and we had a vaccine that stopped that transmission, suddenly you might find that the list has been changed in order. It will be a very dynamic process, and the information that comes out will be kept under review so that we can ensure that we get the maximum benefit from the vaccines for the society.
Okay, well, so many questions yet unanswered or to tease out, and we'll do so in the coming days and weeks on this programme and on other programmes. But for the moment, Professor Karina Butler and Dr. Gabriel Scally, thank you both very much indeed.